listening to Trending with Timory, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics. National speaker Timory Millington has been a passionate advocate for life as long as she can remember, helping Gen X through Z answer the call to true feminism and authentic manhood. Timory holds a master's degree in biblical theology, and she covers this week's hottest stories from a Catholic worldview. You're listening to Trending with Timory.
Hello, dear friends. It's so good to be back in studio with me and to have with me Father Tim Grumbach from St. Augustine's Parish in Los Angeles. We have had a busy few weeks away from social media, which I know has been incredible, I think, for both of us.
Yeah, I thought I'd be a little bit bored without social media, but really, I think I'm living the best life. I miss you all out there, but no, this has been a really important time. It's only 3 weeks and another like 10 weeks to go or something like that before I really get back into it, if I ever do.
So Father Tim's on a fast. He's participating in a men's spiritual formation, essentially.
Spiritual exercises, yeah.
Yeah, it's called the Exodus 90. We talked about it a few weeks ago before you started. And I mean, man, you're all in. You're doing the cold showers, no social media, no drinking, no alcohol. I mean, for many, this is a step into discipline that some people have never experienced before.
Yeah, it's incredible to see some of the guys who jump into it. Is some guys just, they aren't ready for everything. And we need to be careful not to be like, oh, if you don't do one thing, then you're not really doing Exodus 90, even though that language is used sometimes. It's really meant to remind us of the great traditions of the church and asceticism that we're called to. It's right there in the gospel, is to put these things away, to follow Christ. And we know we just heard that in the gospel on Sunday. And so this is a beautiful way. At least 10,000 men are doing this program throughout the United States. I bet it's probably twice that by now.
Right. And it's awesome because it's not just asceticism. It's based on male fraternity. It's based off of accountability. There's so much to the program that I think hits all facets of masculinity that men are hungry for today.
That's right. The fraternity part is so important, because to take on all these exercises by oneself can be so isolating. And once you get isolated and you feel like you're doing this all on your own, you're just going to throw it away. Yeah. Or it could be spiritually dangerous. And so that's why they call it a spiritual boot camp of sorts. I'm not a big fan of that term, but one can think that if you're trying to do these kinds of exercises, a boot camp kind of intensity by yourself, you're going to get hurt, you're going to fall, and you're not going to have anyone to pick you up.
Right.
And so the fraternity makes this program. So.
And ultimately, we're called to relationship. That's part of who we are as human beings. And so it's rooting us within that community to grow and take on this challenge. It's really interesting. I'm not doing the Exodus 90. I actually just got married. And so that's where I've been the last couple weeks. I know we've got like the cheer button kicking in the background here. And so just life hasn't allowed for me to post pictures. I promise I will get photos out over the next 2 days. So keep an eye on my social media at Timory. I was telling Father Tim, a lot of people are sitting here saying, why are you going live on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram, yet you still haven't posted a photo of your wedding? I'm sorry, I'm getting there. But you know, it's really been interesting, because I've shared with some of you personally, the week I got engaged was actually the same week that the sex abuse scandal was really amping up in the church. I think it was right around the same week as the Pennsylvania grand jury report. And I remember just at parts during that week, I remember Father and Tim and I went out to lunch right when it came out. Mm-hmm. And we were sitting there processing it together. And then I became engaged in the middle of that week. And I remember the day after I was engaged, I'm here at Mass and there's so much joy in my heart. Yet the priest is talking about what's going on in the church, and my heart was just breaking. And I remember just sitting there in tears going, wow, what a gift to be called into this vocation of marriage. But we have a lot to do for the church. And there's so much we're called to do in our vocation wherever we're at. We can't step out. We can't lean out of what's going on in the culture. And so then, ironically, the same week that I then get married is right when New York passes this massive abortion law saying, yeah, we're going to make sure within our state, even if Roe versus Wade is overturned, we have full access to abortion through all 9 months. We're going to be talking about that a little later on the show. But to me, it was a reminder that, yeah, there may be wonderful and joyful things happening in our lives, but we're still called to engage the culture. We can't turn our back and be like, oh, I'm married now, or oh, I'm just going to celebrate my engagement. Like, no, we're called to be in the culture, challenge other people to do more and to live as the sons and daughters that God's calling us to be.
It sounds like you're definitely learning, along with all of the other couples getting married during this time, that to be married in the church especially, it's not about you.
Yeah.
It's going to be about the community that you're giving your vows in front of. It's the community that you're now making yourself one flesh in part in front of, that your wedding was not about you. Your marriage will not be about you alone. It'll be about your sanctity, but also, establishing a family, which they call it, the kind of the smallest living cell of the church and of mm-hmm. society. And, this is a really important time for you to be able to see that. And I know you're seeing that, that it's not about you, and, painfully so, that your witness as a married couple is what the world needs to see right now.
I remember one set of friends told me right after they came back from their honeymoon, they're kind of sitting there at home, they're like, this doesn't feel right. More people are supposed to be called into this. And so they very intentionally right away were trying to have a child, because they knew we're called to minister to the world here. We're not supposed to be in our own Shangri-La. Although first and foremost, the spouse comes, before all else here in our faith, in our marriage, we're called to go out shoulder to shoulder as we live this.
Yeah, so I'm really excited. We're going to be talking a little bit more about the domestic church, what it means to be church, but then what does it mean to be family, and how the mission of the family is the mission of the church, and the world needs family, the world needs church.
I want to talk today about Our Lady of Lourdes. We just celebrated our feast day. Many people associate Lourdes, if with nothing else, of healing pools, healing waters, and the miracles, but they forget that along with the miracles came great suffering in St. Bernadette's life.
Mm-hmm. And also the message of Mary, which is not a new message, and that's mm-hmm. how we can kind of discern whether or not this is truly Mary appearing to her children, or if it's something else that we need to actually step away from, is if Mary is, if this image of Mary is trying to give us a new gospel, something new, some sort of new revelation, then we know it's not Mary. But when we realize that she's giving us the same message that Christ gave when he appeared in the deserts by the Jordan, and when John the Baptist baptized him, Jesus's first words were, repent, believe in the gospel. The kingdom of God is at hand. And so Mary, whenever she appears, is, reminding us how important it is to repent, that we were not made to be sinners, and how beautiful it was that she revealed herself as the Immaculate Conception to Saint Bernadette. And as Mary is, so shall we be. And so we learn this message that we are not made to be sinners. Sin actually makes us even less human. And what is the resolution? What is the healing to this? It's not just repentance. No, let me be careful how I say that. It's not just repentance, a turning of the mind, literally turning around, but it's also acts of penance. Mm-hmm. And so it's so beautiful and challenging to people, because we sometimes have such a sweet image of Mary. She's floating 3 feet off the ground. We forget that she calls us to a tough life of penance for the sake of sinners, for our own souls.
Well, it's such a reminder of the spiritual battle, because even then, I think in the fourth vision of Our Lady of Lourdes, in the fourth vision, suddenly St. Bernadette hears something really loud behind her, these loud noises, and someone yelling, like, get out of here, something like, leave this place. And she knows right then it's not anything visible. It's the demons. It's the spiritual warfare of what is good, and this call to healing, this call to redemptive suffering that the demonic does not want the world to participate in, because when they do, it draws about conversion.
Yeah, and I've got to share this quote that I got from St. Gregory the Great. I think we have just enough time to look at this. It just blew me away a couple days ago. He says, evil spirits possess nothing of their own in this world. We must be naked if we are to struggle with other naked beings. If those who are clothed begin to struggle with others who are naked, they are quickly thrown to the ground, since they have something to grasp. What are earthly things except a kind of covering for our bodies? Let us, who are preparing for a contest with the devil, cast off this clothing so that we won't be overcome. Let us hold no possessions in this world through our love for them. We shouldn't seek to take pleasure in things that are passing away, lest the devil grab hold of the desires which clothe us and bring us down.
Break that down, Father Tim. Yeah. Break that down, like the meaning behind that.
Right. You have this image of, the demonic cannot be creative. You know, only God is creative, and we get to actually share in that, you know, procreation, the fruitfulness of our spiritual lives. But to look at the demonic is all they can do is counterfeit. And so they possess nothing. They possess no ability to create, possess no ability to love. And so they are not clothed by these things. They're not, you know, in a way held down by these things. And so you have the image of great spiritual warfare in which the demons will be trying to drag us down by the things that we love.
So that's what he's meaning when he's talking about the clothing. You can't battle against someone that's unclothed and doesn't care about anything, hold on to anything. You need to live that aesthetic lifestyle, just like you right now in the middle of the Exodus 90. You're not using social media. You're not drinking. You're taking all of these things so that you're living a simpler, more modified life.
Right. And, you know, clothing is a good thing.
Yeah, please,
right?
Please, yes, don't, yes, go around,
yeah,
naked,
yeah,
for,
yeah,
anyone.
Yeah. Yeah. But it can be something that we fall in love with. And you know, not just literal clothing, like use of social media, eating between meals. That's something that we've given up. As you mentioned, you know, cold showers, you know, the comfort of like a long hot shower or something like that. The comfort of, you know, snacking during the day, other comforts, that they become things with which we clothe ourselves. But they also become opportunities for us to fall into temptation and to kind of throw that clothing off, clothe ourselves with the Spirit. Otherwise, to hold onto that clothing, it gives the devil something good in our lives to grasp a hold on and to distort it, to disorder it, to turn our passions, which God has placed into our heart, to turn those against us and turn them into, you know, temptations towards sin.
I look at Our Lady at Lourdes, Our Lady of Fatima, and you hear of these great miracles, and I think that's what people hold on to, but they forget that the spiritual demonic battle is real, and that's something that comes up in both of these, but they both call for this deep, deep element of offering up our suffering, this redemptive suffering. And why does Our Lady invite us into this? Because it's effective. It transforms us and it transforms others.
Timory will be right back. Tweet them at Timory. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Timory, where morality and culture meet, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
Father Tim Grumbach is here in studio with me. Timory here. I've got to get out of the habit of saying Timory Millington. I'm Timory Jaja now. I am now married. So really exciting day here in studio for that. But in the midst of that, I was mentioning before, Father Tim, that as I'm sitting here, like, I'm married. I'm so excited. The same week I'm married, preparing for the marriage, all of a sudden, New York is legalizing abortion through all 9 months of a woman's pregnancy. Now, I have to tell you, myself and some of my pro-life friends were actually kind of annoyed at the fact that suddenly people are in uproar over the fact that abortion's accessible through all 9 months. It has been. The state of California for years, UCLA is offering late-term abortions at discounted rates because there at UCLA, it's the students practicing and performing the abortions. There's so many states where abortion through all 9 months is accessible and regular. And so it's great because people are now aware of this more so than they were before. But this is a challenge if you're really touched and really upset by the fact that abortion's legal through all 9 months in New York, and they're creating these protections so that if Roe v. Wade is overturned, that state has abortion access. I want you to convict your heart. These babies are dying every single day in your state. What are you doing about it?
Yeah, I haven't been able to read up too much on this idea, but I'm sure you probably know a little bit more about it. Has there been sort of I know that tourism is the most awful word we could use for that, but a traveling in order to, you know, from one state to another for these women who have been seeking such procedures?
Traveling from one state to another is normal in the state. So say maybe one state has a heartbeat protection after 16, 20 weeks or fetal pain protection so that they've really outlawed abortion. The reality is two things. You had two court cases, Roe versus Wade and Doe versus Bolton, and between the two of them, not only did they restrict, they take away the restrictions to abortion, but they made abortion accessible at a federal level through all 9 months of a woman's pregnancy. So even when a local law might limit abortion, if the woman pushes hard enough, she can still access abortion because of the federal law, which is why in 1992, we had the court case of Casey versus Planned Parenthood. And in that court case, they talked about how there can can be no undue burden placed on the woman when she's seeking to have an abortion. So what that did is yet again make it that federal law trumped local law. So if a woman wants an abortion, even though there's restrictions after 10 or 20 weeks, whatever it might be, if she requests it, she can still access that abortion.
Yeah, and that language is starting to sound a lot like when we'll be talking about this a little bit later, that the difference between liberty and license is that look at what the government is allowing us to do rather than us having a true personal liberty that helps us to grow in virtue.
Yes, and this is where we have to continue to be aware of what the abortion laws have been. And, you know, we just celebrated life and the number of people who are willing to stand up and speak against Roe versus Wade when all these people were at the March for Life, the Walk for Life in San Francisco. But we're called to do more than march. We're called to volunteer at the crisis pregnancy centers, help fund the crisis pregnancy centers, be out in front of the abortion clinic praying. There's so much more that we can do. And also part of that is using our rhetoric. You know, I think the abortion movement's peeking its head right now, Father Tim, as they're saying, hey, we're seeing that abortion access might go away possibly. So we're going to make sure that not only is abortion accessible through all 9 months of a woman's pregnancy, but infanticide should be an option too, as some people, I think in Vermont, they're saying.
Yeah, and that was the language in Virginia. I know it was, you know, when the question came up about whether or not a child would be able to keep its life if it survived an abortion. And it seemed that their language was very much, yes. No, that child should die.
Yeah, you're correct. In Virginia, and it was really interesting because the governor of Virginia was actually talking about how not only should we discuss the options after the baby's born, and yeah, you know, give the baby some medical treatment then, but let's discuss the options as the medical treatment's taking place. He's advocating for infanticide, but it's not that surprising, Father Tim, with what came out over the last couple weeks. There was a finding of his old school textbook, and essentially what they found in the textbook is that this Virginia governor actually was dressed up as a member of the KKK, and this was from his 1984 Eastern Virginia Medical School. And he's dressed up as part of the KKK. And remember, the KKK was in favor of so many things like genocide, infanticide, and here he is.
Yeah. Well, you know, genocide, infanticide, you know, that's the proper language for what we're looking at. That's rising up throughout the United States right now. And it's such a complicated mess of a story that, you know, he seems to kind of admit, oh, you know, okay, I'm sorry. That was, you know, from my younger days, my school days. And, you know, where have we heard that language before? You know, this is, you know, these are locker room pictures, right? But then he tries to kind of backtrack around and say, oh, I've looked around. It turns out that's not me in the picture.
That was a quarter page that was dedicated just to him in his yearbook.
Yeah.
And he outright acknowledges that he's in the photo, but he never says which person he is because one of them has the KKK hood on and the other person is painted like a black person.
Right.
So we don't know which guy he is, but one of those is him. And he acknowledges, yes, I'm sorry, especially for the pain that it's caused some people. And, you know, good for some of the Democrat Party who's calling for his resignation, but he's not going to resign.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, lest we get too far afield, we remember that this is somehow all related to what we're seeing in New York, what we're seeing in Virginia, what we're seeing throughout much of the country is, you know, it really points to the poor misunderstanding of personhood. You know, where does personhood begin? When does it begin? Who do we claim our persons? This is language that goes back, well, really since the dawn of our understanding of human personhood. But look at, you know, the United States history of slavery. You know, who are persons? Who's, you know, what is it? 2/3 of a person. And now that's the language revolving around the abortion issue is, oh, those aren't persons that were, you know, terminating the pregnancy. And so this complete misunderstanding of who the person is at the heart of that. And so it's almost this, you know, demonic relation right there of language that is willing to speak of abortion and to take away the personhood of this new life in the mother's womb, but also, you know, to look into someone's past and kind of wonder about their understanding of personhood of fully grown humans of a different race.
Well, and it's so shocking too when you look at it. You know, we're talking about later term abortion, which again, it bothers me that some people are suddenly worked up about this when it's been accessible in this country since Roe versus Wade in 1972. But you look and, I mean, I know people who have said, I remember my mom being pregnant. And years later, they find out, oh, yeah, she had an abortion. Mm-hmm. Oh, Yeah, I remember my mom being pregnant. I remember, you know, she was pregnant with a little boy. I remember she was pregnant with a little girl. You know, I remember maybe feeling the baby kick. Like, these babies are so developed. It's not like where you can't tell a woman's pregnant yet. And although the baby's heart is beating and everything in that baby's body's developing, like, we're talking about babies that are so developed, we know they are present.
And I understand that one of the arguments for this late-term abortion is for, you know, mother's health reasons, that nobody gets to that point in their pregnancy, says, oh my gosh, I'm pregnant, I need to get rid of this child, you know, in more or less in that language.
Right. But you know what? The one news network that actually covered the story of New York suddenly legalizing abortion in this way through all 9 months or giving further access was actually Fox News. And they actually brought on an OBGYN gynecologist. And what they ended up discussing is how he said there is no reason in the third trimester for a woman to abort her child, neither for the sake of the life of the child nor for the sake of the life of the mother. It may require in the third trimester a premature delivery, but not a death.
Even to the point of an emergency C-section, right?
Yes. Absolutely. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so it's really important that, you know, the OBGYN medical community itself is sitting here saying, no, we do not have to give this access to abortion for the sake of the mother's health or for the sake of the child, in fact. And in what ways is for the sake of the child? We're supposed to be pro-woman, pro-life, pro-human. That means we have a consistent ethic both toward the child that is developing and growing and is in its natural space that it's meant to be in. It's not some disease to be gotten rid of.
Right. And, you know, just looking at the language that's being used, you know, the necessity of this, you know, that we've come a long ways from rare, safe, and legal, right? The rallying cry for legalizing abortion here in the United States, to where it's being cheered as a victory as the governor pens these, you know, laws into being. And I think that's one of the most disturbing parts of this. And really, see, that's what's, you know, driving the pro-life community right now into a, you know, not fear, not by any means that, but there's a greater urgency. Yeah.
I think we need to be better prepared to have these conversations. You know, so often people say, well, I'll live the example of being pro-life. I'll go to the March for Life. I'll go to the Walk for Life. Those are great things, but we need to dive into the conversations because a lot of people do not understand that there is no medical necessity for a late-term abortion. I mean, a woman who, let's say a woman's in her 8th month of pregnancy. She's in that last term. She doesn't have much longer to go. However, she has cancer and she desperately needs medical treatment. She could choose to forego the medical treatment, right? The chemotherapy, whatever she might be offered until after the baby is born.
And there have been some great saints actually who've lived that out.
Miraculously. Mm-hmm. I mean, Saint Gianna is one example. I can't remember what illness she had, but she foregoed medical treatment so that she could give birth to her child. And I actually, off to repost the picture, have met her daughter. Her daughter looks just like Saint Gianna, and she's a miracle of redemptive suffering. Her mother forewent any type of medical treatment. And so, but let's say there are some women who said, no, I'm actually going to receive this chemotherapy. Now, they're receiving chemotherapy. The baby might die in the process of chemotherapy.
And we're looking at the law of double effect here.
Right. Yes. That wasn't her intention. That may potentially happen, though. Again, it's a choice there, but she's not intentionally receiving chemotherapy to kill the child the way she's receiving an abortion to intentionally kill the child.
And we're looking at some very dramatic situations in which, you know, people can use the argument for late-term abortion here. But what we're losing still and not being part of that conversation is the personhood of the woman, the personhood of the child, and how to be compassionate and caring for these people rather than taking their lives.
I really hope that if you are impacted by this change in abortion laws and the call even for infanticide, that you really choose to stand up and do more. Tweet me, send me a message on Facebook. We can talk about it.
Timory will be right back. Tweet them at Timory. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Timory.
Timory here. I'm in studio with Father Tim Grumbach. He is a regular guest here on Trending. You can catch more about Father Tim and all of the episodes where he joins us talking about the importance of our faith in light of current cultural issues and how we can dive deeper into aestheticism, into worship. So you can head over to radiotrending.com where all the episodes with Father Tim are available at your leisure. Make your phone a mobile radio. So, Father Tim, you and I were talking this week about a really awesome apostolic letter exhortation that came out of the Denver Diocese.
Phoenix, actually.
Phoenix. Yeah, okay, sorry. Phoenix. Yeah, yeah. Just a couple months ago, and it's titled Complete My Joy, and it's by Bishop Olmsted. This letter is specifically to married persons and families.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right. And it's a letter where he's writing to his people in Phoenix. And so he will often make examples of something that they're far more familiar with. So it may seem a little bit out of our reach, our understanding. But what it comes out as is a father speaking to his spiritual children. And it's beautiful, the simplicity of that. But he's not afraid to go into some deeper theology. Yeah. Bishop Olmsted, actually, before he was a bishop, I believe, worked for St. John Paul II while he was pope. So he spent quite a bit of time in Rome. So Bishop Olmsted, it seems that his role there was translating into English summaries of the theology of the body as it was happening.
Isn't this incredible to see? And you see his deep understanding of theology of the body, of the elements of, for me personally, something I, when I've worked deeply with theology of the body as my thesis, talked about it at times as redemptive suffering and how marriage ultimately is an act of redemptive suffering. So that's something we're going to get to a little later on in the show.
Yeah, you know, those poor married couples who have me preach at their weddings will often hear something like, oh, marriage is a cross, you know, because marriage is a sacrament. It is not only a means of sanctification for the spouses who bestow the sacrament upon one another, but it is also a matter of worship. And there's no such thing as worship without sacrifice. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of, you know, God bless our Christian brothers and sisters, have found ways of beautiful praise and what they call worship, but it's really lacking this element of sacrifice that we have in the Eucharist. And so this, the fullness of this image of a wedding celebration with the Eucharist present and being consecrated, it shows that it's not just a matter of sanctification between a married couple, right? It's not about them, but it's about them offering their bodies as a living sacrifice, as St. Paul reminds us in Romans 12. It's so beautiful, this image that the family is a sacrament, that the family is an icon of the Holy Trinity, which finds itself so present in the teachings of the past few popes, you know, from John Paul II into Benedict, and now Francis is taking up the same language of the family as a unique icon of the Holy Trinity.
The most perfect example and model of the family is ultimately the Trinity. And I know that might seem far-fetched because you think, okay, God is spirit, God is asexual, so he's not male or female, but the Trinity is that model of sacrificial love. It is that model of the outpouring, the total self-gift of the Father to the Son. And that love that's so deep between the Father and the Son is the Holy Spirit in that presence. And God gives us his Spirit to live a life contrary to what were the results of the fall in the garden, to overcome that temptation, our own natural vices that we have as a cause of original sin.
Yes, and the precision of the language of the church is that, you know, God is neither male nor female, but the perfections that you find in masculinity and femininity are found in God. And it is God, you know, the overflowing love of the Holy Trinity that flows into masculinity, that flows into femininity, and then, you know, brings the two together, male and female, in the sacrament of marriage. It's it, you know, this is well thought out, and this brings up the dignity of who we are, created male and female, and what that can do for the family, and how, you know, any misunderstanding of personhood, masculinity, femininity, maleness, femaleness, can lead to a breakdown, a desacralization of the sacrament of marriage, where it becomes, you know, less a covenant and more just like worldly contracts.
And I love that. Something that Bishop Olmsted really discusses in the letter, where he starts to point to the fact that there are differences between men and women, and let's talk about them. And he's willing to go into territories that for so many people, even spouses between themselves, they don't want to talk about. For example, the importance of the woman, the wife, the mother being present in the home specifically. And we know this from psychological development of the child, of the tactile development of the child. That child needs its mother present all the time for those first few years, in particular, if not the whole development of the child, of that baby growing up, because you're shaping a soul, you're shaping a person. And what better person to be more compassionate, aware, intuitive than the mother?
Right. And it's become a sacrifice in our society today to speak of a mother staying at home with her children. And, you know, I know many mothers who work their tails off, especially single mothers, who just work so hard to raise their children and to provide a good life for them. So this isn't, you know, in any way condemning that kind of situation, but this is important for us to reflect on and to humbly receive the suggestion from Bishop Olmsted to consider, how can we call mothers back into the home so that the father can provide for his family and the mother can provide for her family by being present at home while the children are being raised? The mistake I think that we make sometimes is calling motherhood, you know, mothers who stay at home, as if that's their profession, mm-hmm. to compare it equally to what's happening in the outside world and say, oh, that's your job. It's like, no, it's so much more than a job. It's so much more than a profession. It's a vocation.
And Bishop Olmsted opposes it as a challenge to mm-hmm. families. Like, mm-hmm. this is going to be challenging. This is going to require sacrifice. And he said, I recognize there are some families where this is just impossible at this state in time. But it's something that we're called to constantly reevaluate, if maybe that's where you're at. But in reality, you know, and it's so real where he talks about, well, maybe you can have fewer cars. It's difficult. I remember my parents, we had one car. I remember when I was younger, and I mean, later on, we were able to have another car. But again, we had one car and, you know, we worked it out. We made it work. And this is what happens within the family. And even seeing my family now, they're, you know, they're teenagers, right? I have my younger siblings and they're having to bounce the car back and forth. People have to be home at a certain time. It calls for this sacrifice within the entire family, even if it's not just when your children are smaller. But it's that sacrifice that you're making so that the mother can be present to the best of her ability.
Yeah, one of my favorite sections in this whole letter, which is called Complete My Joy, Bishop Olmsted runs through the marital vows that are made during the sacramental wedding ceremony. And I had never heard this before. You know,
I'm
no expert at weddings. I've been doing them for about a year and a half now as a priest. But now it's turned my whole understanding of those vows upside down to hear the language that I've become so familiar with from Humanae Vitae. And so then in Theology of the Body is that, you know, the spousal love is free, total, faithful, and fruitful. Mm-hmm. And that all of those come from the wedding vows.
Yes.
And so he runs through the questions. Here, you know, first of all, what is the iconic experience of free, total, faithful, fruitful love? But the cross, mm-hmm. you know, that Jesus did it freely. He didn't need to. He could have called on the angel armies to come down and tear Rome apart and show victory in this world that way. It was total because you can't say that Jesus held anything back on the cross. It was faithful because he showed God's fidelity like no other action, no other miracle possibly could have. And it was fruitful because, well, we're here talking about this. We are a church. The church exists. That we enter into that sacrifice itself. And so that gives us an understanding of what it means to say that true sacrificial self-giving love is free, total, faithful, and fruitful. And so you just hear it in the wedding vows, is these questions that the priest or the deacon ask is, have you come here to enter marriage without coercion, freely and wholeheartedly, freely and totally? Are you prepared as you follow the path of marriage to love and honor each other for as long as you both shall live? You know, lifelong fidelity, faithfulness. And that also reveals God's love through fidelity. And then fruitfully, are you prepared to accept children lovingly from God and bring them up according to the law of Christ and his church? You know, the fruitfulness. And, you know, yes, there are some circumstances where married couples struggle with infertility. It doesn't make them less of a married couple or less able to be fruitful sacramentally for the good of not just their family, but the church. But it's that free, total, faithful, fruitful love pouring out from the side of Christ in the water and the blood, from the pierced side of Christ that makes the sacraments. So we look at the sacraments and we know that there is a grace that flows through them. We'll be hearing it in the readings this coming week is, you know, the just man is like a tree planted by running waters. You know, even though the heat comes to scorch it, it will not die. Even though the drought comes to take away, you know, to wither its branches, it will still have that source of grace. And Bishop Olmsted reaches into that later in the document to say, look, you're going to suffer in your marriage. And some marriages seem insufferable, just the worst possible suffering in the family. But if you're not reaching into the grace that the sacrament of your marriage has to offer you, it's going to be deadly.
Well, that's what Our Lady of Sorrows, Our Lady of Lourdes mm-hmm. keeps offering. And she's saying, take this sacrifice you're experiencing now. And this is what the sacrament of marriage calls us, whatever it might be. Maybe it's illness in the family. Maybe it has been infidelity. Maybe it has been loneliness. I mean, there's so many things. Each family has its unique struggles, whatever it is, and use it for the redemption of your family members. Offer this suffering. Don't let it go wasted.
Yes, and Bishop Olmsted offers this, you know, this advice and encouragement that when you offer your suffering up to God, he will use it like oil from the press to anoint your family. In this way, you mysteriously but truly participate in the redemption of those whom you love most in the world. I mean, what could be more like the cross?
I love that. See that part about the oil again.
When you offer your suffering up to God, he will use it like oil from the press to anoint your family.
To anoint your family. Yeah. I mean, you are bestowing your marital graces upon your family when you offer up the sufferings within the family. That's why I wish that we discussed and use more so this language of marriage as redemptive suffering. Mm-hmm. That is what it is. But that is also the cross of each and every single one of our lives, is that marriage, not just marriage, the priestly vocation, the sacrifices that we are making right here, right now, the duties that you are performing, it's not for the sake of this job that I'm living out, but it's for the sake of sacrificial love and the transformation that's meant to come about.
And how could any other worldview but Christianity, and how can any other Christianity but a sacramental Catholicism pour this grace into the world so that suffering may become like an oil that is pressed to anoint one's family?
Timory will be right back. Tweet them at Timory. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Timory, where morality and culture meet, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
Timory here with Father Tim Grumbach. Just a couple weeks ago when I was married, I actually chose, and my sister did as well, to adopt a Bosnia-Herzegovian tradition for the rite of marriage. And that is where you're actually married and you say your vows to one another, holding a crucifix with the stole of the priest wrapped around your hands. And at one point, it's commented as right after the crucifix is blessed, the priest exclaims, "You have found your cross. It is a cross to love, to carry with you, a cross that is not thrown off, but rather treasured." And for me, when I had learned about this tradition some years ago, one of the interesting things is that actually within this Soroki Brejing village and area where it's celebrated, they have 13,000 inhabitants, and not a single one of them who practice this marriage rite on the crucifix have a single divorce or broken family. And I think that this is the key. And this is part of the turning point of theology of the body, Father Tim, is this idea that we are called to life-giving, self-giving love.
Right. And it goes back to the sacrament of marriage and the family being an icon of that self-giving love. One of my favorite parts of all of the theology of the body is really it's at the foundation of St. John Paul II's Carmelite spirituality. It's a bizarrely named concept. I believe it's pronounced the San Juanist Triangle, going back to St. John of the Cross, mm-hmm. and this understanding of what it means to be self-gift and how that is lived in the Holy Trinity. And then how is that, an icon, how is that iconized, I suppose, iconicized in the lived family life of the married couple. And so, the three points of the San Juanist Triangle are love implies a cycle of mutual self-giving, supremely the gift of self. And so it's not, when we give gifts, we want to give something that best resembles or represents our relationship with that person. But the supreme gift that one can give is not something else, but themselves. And so then it goes on, and the paradigmatic instance of such self-gift in human experience is the spousal relationship between man and woman. Mm-hmm. Paradigmatic is that this is the clearest icon of the love of the Holy Trinity is the self-gift between husband and wife, which it becomes so concrete, so real that, as they joke about it, you have to give it a name in 9 months, right?
Isn't that so true?
Yeah. And then the third point is that the Trinity is the archetype of such love and gift, from which the love between God and human persons, as well as the love between human beings, derives as an imitation and participation. Mm-hmm. See, I love that they approach it from both contexts of you're imitating the love of the Holy Trinity as self-gift. But it's not just something you imitate that you're disconnected from ultimately, but it's something that you actually participate in. Again, what other worldview could give us this but Christianity? And what other Christianity could give this to us other than a sacramental Catholicism?
And look at how it's the fact that it's not just that you're making sacrifices for your spouse, but you're seeing the benefit of making sacrifices to your spouse in the fact that the benefit is that you're growing closer to God by uniting your suffering for your spouse, for your children, to God. And this is where, again, the fact that so many of the apparitions of Our Lady, so many of the saints have called us to redemptive suffering, and that's ultimately the image of the cross. And what it makes me think of in Bishop Olmsted's letter that we're looking at, Complete My Joy, he quotes Fulton Sheen at one point. He talks about how some people actually may have this great degree of sanctity, yet it's still difficult. And he talks about how to remain on the cross until the end in the world is full of half-crucified souls who have come down from the cross at the challenge of the world after an hour. So he's talked about how so many people refuse to remain on the cross. They're only half-crucified souls because they're going through the pain in their families, but maybe they're complaining. Maybe they're opting out. Maybe they're looking for distractions. Maybe they outright leave. You're a half-crucified soul walking around for the completion of a theological term we call Christosis. Mm-hmm. And in Christosis, you become like Christ. It's a process.
Yeah. And then it becomes only a half kenosis, right? A
yes.
Half emptying out. And that's such a powerful.
So hold on. Kenosis, oh, no. For those who don't know. So Christosis is becoming like Christ, but kenosis is, okay, I'm becoming like Christ, but now I'm pouring everything I have back out.
Right. It's an emptying out.
Yeah.
And we get it from the kenotic hymn of St. Paul in the second chapter of the letter to the Philippians, where, you know, though Jesus Christ was in the form of God, he did not deem equality with God something to be grasped at, but rather he emptied himself, taking the form of a slave. And then hinging at that poem, that song, that hymn is the crucifixion of Christ, who, you know, he's humble and he's emptying himself in the first half of the hymn. In the second half, you know, it's his name to which every knee will bow, you know, and he's greatly exalted because of the sacrifice that he's made. So it's so convicting, that image of a half crucified soul.
Oof.
is that, could you imagine Jesus being taken off the cross before he died?
Yeah.
You know, the redemption that would take away from us, certainly in a soteriological, salvific sense, but physically, he would not have been able to move on his own. He would have had to have been carried away. You know, he endured such brutality. You know, there'd be no salvation, and he'd be of no use.
Yeah.
He may not even survive. And so it's what's convicting about that is to think of ourselves entering into that same crucifixion and then taking ourselves down from the cross. We'd be almost useless.
Yeah. It's like someone who hasn't allowed themselves to heal, mm-hmm. or to forgive or move past maybe even mm-hmm. the injury they've experienced. You know, we don't allow the completion of God's work to take place when we refuse to cooperate with the pain that is real. The pain, in fact, that God allowed to be human.
Mm-hmm.
You know, God allowed this pain to be human. God allowed us to contemplate our pain, allowed us to push through the challenge of our pain. And, you know, Fulton Sheen, in continuing with that quote we mentioned, he talked about how very few are like our Savior, who will stay there on that cross till the end. But that is what Christosis is. That is what all of our vocations are, the life of the cross.
Yeah, one of the images that I found most ridiculous about the cross is, I don't know if you've seen it before, but it's this buff, muscular Jesus kind of snapping the arms off the cross. I'm like, that's exactly the opposite of what happened on Calvary that day, is that Jesus was not physically impressive. He was not physically defeating death in that way. The only way that he chose to defeat death was to let death defeat him. To defeat death by death is that great Easter hymn. So this isn't a matter of Jesus looking impressive and looking strong by defeating death on the cross, but it's, you know, Jesus had to give up. I don't think we take that seriously enough, is that Jesus had to give up on his cross. And by doing so, you know, gave up his spirit so that we could have it.
You mean give himself? He didn't give up. He didn't
right.
quit. He
well,
gave every, like
he gave everything.
He surrendered to that extent of saying, okay,
yeah,
I'm here.
Yeah. At a physical level, he had to stop trying to hold himself up. Mm-hmm. He had to just let death overtake him. So no, he didn't give up in the sense of, you know, all is lost, but physically he had to stop fighting. Mm-hmm. You know, the body will fight death for as long as it can. He had to physically let his body stop fighting to stay alive. So in a sense, when we think about our crosses in the sense that Fulton Sheen invites us into it, is that, you know, maybe we fight too much against the crosses that God puts into our lives. Earlier in Complete My Joy, Bishop Olmsted also quotes Archbishop Fulton Sheen again in another place where he talks about the necessity of the cross, especially in family life, where he says, well, first he introduces it. He says, to look at Jesus on the cross is to realize that he knows our suffering from the inside. Mm. From the inside. Jesus knows our suffering better than we do. And so he quotes Fulton Sheen again. What do the scars of Christ teach us? They teach us that life is a struggle, that our condition of a final resurrection is exactly the same as his. That unless there's a cross in our lives, there will never be an empty tomb. That unless there's a Good Friday, there will never be an Easter Sunday. That unless there's a crown of thorns, there will never be a halo of light. And that unless we suffer with him, we shall not rise with him.
Yeah. And look at that. Unless there is a cross in our lives, there will never be a tomb. And think about the significance of Christ's tomb, but also our tomb, that there will be never be a tomb if we do not make sacrifices for people, because no one will honor us in our death if we have not honored them in our life. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and knowing that the scars of our lives, the way that we've honored people by giving of ourselves, that not giving up, like this is too much, but giving of ourselves, right? We're looking at this paradigmatic image and icon of God's love lived in our lives is as self-gift, right? You have the image of Christ appearing to his disciples. I love this. I was challenged by a young man once when I asked him the question, what do you think Jesus' resurrection was like? And he told me, and I'd never thought of this before, he said, I bet Jesus woke up, like breath just like surged back into his body. And he said, I want to go see my friends. I want to show them what's just happened and nothing's going to stop me, right? Nothing could. So he walked through locked doors and he stood there, and Jesus healed so many people in his life that you imagine Jesus could have healed the scars, but he kept the scars on his hands and his side to show them, this is what's going to bring healing to the world now. And then there's this terribly convicting mystical image of the only man-made thing in heaven are the scars on Jesus's hands and in his side.
Ooh.
Yeah. But he kept those for a reason. And the reason was to show us not that suffering is good in itself, not that God loves suffering, but the suffering he went through out of love. And so the scars of Christ have so much to say to us. And another point that Bishop Olmsted makes about suffering, he says that this world, we're experiencing less physical suffering in this world.
Yeah, he said toothache used before. To be a big deal. Now, yeah. We have the medication to ease it.
Yeah, but there's never been more suffering in families.
Yeah.
Yeah, an incredible image of, in the prayers of the church, we don't really ask God to take away our suffering, do we? I've been wrestling with the prayer after the Our Father in the Mass for the last couple of weeks of, deliver us, O Lord, we pray, from every evil, We ask God to deliver us from evil, from distress, from sin, but not from suffering. Because only the church can show us, because of, who our bridegroom is, that suffering means something in this world. It's not meaningless.
And there's something transformative about that. And we can't forget, and this is something that is explicitly Catholic, that, our Protestant brothers and sisters don't understand. My former co-host, Don Johnson, used to always say, I don't understand the suffering part. It's something that I'm still learning because it's not something I grew up with. But suffering transforms us. It is human. It is redemptive. It is contemplative, and it will bring about great renewal if we only allow it.
This has been Trending with Timory. To learn more about Timory Millington, visit timory.com.